You're supposed to actually have conversation.
Going to call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for this January 22nd.
March
22nd. Well into spring. Very happy about that. Let me talk a little bit about why we're here in this strange setting, in this strange place. This is only the second time I've ever done this. We did it as Tom Burns was reminding me before for hospital 2009.
Maybe pull your microphone just a little closer. I think some people are having trouble hearing.
And I do want to say that the PA system in here is not the same as the hearing room, so we will want to project our voices a little bit.
All right, I will project my voice a little bit. Hear ye, hear ye. We're set up this way today because I really want the committee to have a chance to work the prescription drug bill. Representative Nose put the bill together on behalf of the committee, and I believe this is a whole committee process, and this will be the penultimate time that the committee will meet on this bill. The next time we meet, my recommendation is we have a final bill to vote on. So I'm going to ask you all to enter into the discussion. In fact, I'm going to start by asking us to go around the room and asking each of you to give an initial impression of the bill and where you are now and what you're thinking of. And after we have that, and when we get to Representative Nose, he'll talk about the bill in greater detail and where he is. If I prefer to have this meeting rather informal, so if you feel like breaking in at any point, do. If you feel like raising your hand, I'll be glad to acknowledge you. But let's have a discussion in a way that's real. If any of you want to call somebody up to answer a question from the audience, you're welcome. Representative Nose, the same. You have a few more chips. If you want to have anybody join us, we'll pull a chair up. But let's take the time we have and let's use it well. You willing to start? Can we go around this way, Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Chair Greenlake. I don't have to introduce myself in this setting.
No, you don't.
Okay. So this is a pretty comprehensive bill that we've been working on. I appreciate Co-Chair Rob Nose on putting this together. It's difficult to try and put this type of legislation together that has such strong feelings, and appropriately so, on both sides of the coin. In looking at what the bill is trying to accomplish to do, I'm strongly supportive of trying to rein in some of the healthcare costs that we have that has been difficult for us to get our hands around, difficult for us to control healthcare costs. I'm a little concerned that this bill might be a little too aggressive, some would call a little experimental, in the realm of what it could affect, particularly our clients. Small portions of our Oregonians rely on some of these unique drug therapies, biologicals that help them have longer, better, more successful lives. And so I'm concerned about going a little too far that we could put that in jeopardy. However, I agree with the fact that it's an important conversation to have. Under Section 1, I would be interested in looking at something that dealt with price gouging, off-patent, or generic drugs, rather than taking the whole set of drugs, and take a step forward in this direction where we say we're not going to allow the pharma bro idea, we're not going to allow EpiPens to go up 7,000%. And I think that would be a reasonable step towards finding some sideboards or some solutions within the pharmaceutical industry that help us curb costs without going the whole mile with the bill. So I don't want to take up a whole bunch of time. I think there's validity in what we're trying to accomplish. My concern is it's just going a little too far, too fast. Let's take a smaller portion of it at a time.
Okay, I guess I'll go next. Well, first of all, as a new legislator, I'm very impressed with the process of this, that this is a very tough problem that lots of people care about. And I'm very proud to, even though I'm kind of coming in the middle of the process, to be part of this conversation, because I think, you know, difficult problems take a lot of time to process. And the work group I got, even before I was elected, I got to peek in on some of the hearings, and I talked with the work group and talked to a lot of different people. And it was good to know that there's lots of voices to this. But I go back personally to when I ran for office. And as I knocked on doors and talked to people about what their concerns is, as soon as they found I was a nurse, almost invariably, the high cost of prescription drugs, and I would hear the personal stories over and over and over again. And then they would say, well, if you get elected, well, just promise you're going to do something about this. And I said, I'm going to try. So I want to make sure that we pass a bill, you know, if this bill or some amendments to it, whatever we do, I want to come back to the people that told me over and over and over again categorically that we need to do something. And so that's what I'm here to hear, the conversations about what we can do to make the very best bill that we can.
Chair, can I take a pass? I wasn't prepared for this, so I'm gathering my thoughts.
Sure.
I get in either. Line?
I noticed you gathered them away. I thought that was really good.
As long as it's not a pass permanently, right? It's got to go back.
Come me back at the end of the round.
You're the vice chair.
Okay, so I guess I'll go next. So similar to Rep. Malmstrom, one of the reasons why I was really excited to be part of this committee was specifically to address and help in hopes in my role here is to really represent our community who shared with me the cost of health is really expensive for me. You know, what was really interesting, one of my most memorable meetings in my campaign as well was I went to go speak to home care workers. And I thought I was going to be hearing from home care workers about salaries and their challenges or issues. What ended up happening was that they were home care workers who were parents to children with disabilities. They didn't talk about themselves as home care workers. They were talking to me as parents and the challenges they had with the access to medication for their children. And this medicine wasn't just specifically to help heal. In some cases, these were issues around life or death. And so that, for me, sparked something around how can I be part of helping better a system or support a system so it functions better for our families. And certainly with that process is making sure that healthcare is affordable, that medication is affordable, because a lot of families in my district are low income, and they're working families. And so, and I think this bill addresses, or will help address, some of the challenges that the families in my community are experiencing, and that's being able to afford to be sick. Thank you.
Just in the pack, I'd ask the members give an introductory comment on the drug bill. I'll pass you for a moment and give you a chance to catch your thoughts, unless you...
An introductory on our thoughts on the health bill?
Yeah.
Oh, I can just be really brief, because I think part of why we're here, I think, is really to hear from other folks. I don't want to take very long, so I'll just be really quick. I think for me, it was pretty evident in the last conversations that we had about about this bill that I have an absolute responsibility to my constituents to do the very best that I can to be diligent in understanding the premise of the bill and to make sure that we do everything that we can to provide prescription drugs at a lower cost, not to increase premiums, not to stifle innovation, but to really do what we say we're going to do, and that is to provide lower cost prescriptions and not increase premiums. And those were, you know, those are the things that are most important for me to be able to take back to my constituents, because there isn't any one of us that doesn't have a constituent or any one of us personally that hasn't dealt with this, the horrific issues related to the cost of healthcare and the availability of prescriptions and the cost of them. I want to commend Representative Nose for his dedication and time that he spent working on this, and everyone else that was involved. I wasn't involved in that, so I certainly don't know everything that happened in there, but I just know that it's important that we ask those questions and that we get the answers that we can take back to our constituents. So thank you, Representative Nose, for all your work, and I look forward to hearing from other people that have other thoughts on that today. And thank you, Chair Greenlick, for making this a priority.
Okay. Well, thank you. Ditto on everything that everyone has said about wanting to make sure that we keep costs down to the extent possible. And I know we're trying to do this in a lot of different areas. There was some talk last time about why not try in other settings, like hospitals or PBMs. Certainly, I think that this committee has been very honed in on every single way in which we can try to reduce costs, including offering more coordinated care, wrapping in mental health, oral health into physical health, putting an emphasis on prevention, and trying to get all populations covered. So I'll leave that kind of behind and say this is yet another area that we need to really get on top of. It's not that it's more or less important than others. They're all very important. There was also some question about why isn't this done at the federal level, and I feel very strongly that things are stuck in many ways at the federal level, and I'm not pointing to any one particular administration. I think that's been true over time under various administrations, so that's not meant to be a dig anywhere. I just think things get stuck at the federal level, and I think states can really be the innovative ground. And so with that regard, I really just hats off to Rob and to everyone that was involved in the effort to try to come up with something very innovative and a way to get at this in a way that no one in our country has yet been able to get at. So I do think it's bold. I think it's very thoughtful. And I am highly in favor of it in principle for a variety of reasons. The main one being that I think that that there was a real attempt to do a cost sharing among the three different groups impacted, which is the patients who are using the drugs and some of whom have very high drug costs. So I think capping it at $100 a month is still hard for some people, but it allows it to be predictable and it allows it to be something that they can do. Having insurance pay its share, and I know there's been a lot of talk about this is allowing insurance to have a windfall, and I don't see it that way at all. Insurance still is going to have to pick up a lot of the cost. We don't know how much of the cost, but they're going to have to pick up a lot of the cost up until the trigger is hit, at which the price, when the price of the drug exceeds the average for the price in the five highest countries, so not five lowest countries, but five highest countries, whether that's France, Switzerland, wherever, at the point that our price exceeds that, then the rebate would go into effect. And so I see this, so in many cases, insurance is still going to have to pick up a lot of the cost, which means that does get shared with the insurance holders, the public at large who are paying for those insurance premiums. So I see that as very fair. And when you talk about whether this is going to stifle innovation, I don't believe it will. I think there's going to be, as a result of this, there will have to be more of a cost sharing among a variety of different countries. Right now, if you say, well, the U.S. is paying a lot more because we need to pay for the R&D, and yet the other countries that are significantly behind us, number 2, 3, 4, 5 in price, that are significantly behind us, we are not selling those at a loss. We're selling them at less of a profit. And so we are really picking up the cost for all that R&D. So I think this is a way to try to get at evening that out, trying to get a better deal, frankly. I think the insurance, we have an excellent rate setting process. And if part of today is to get more questions answered about that, I know we've had a lot of those discussions in this committee over the years. And I'm really proud of the rate setting process we have and of Osberg and others who have been a strong part of making sure that we're one of the most transparent, most effective rate-setting processes in the country. So anyway, I'll stop with that. I just have a very, very favorable view of this. And if there's tweaks to be made, particularly on the transparency pieces, you know, I defer to some others on some of those, getting into the weeds on transparency. But overall, the vision of it and the cost sharing of it and the making sure that we look at where we are vis-a-vis the rest of the world in terms of cost sharing, I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, I've been jotting notes feverishly, and not sure how organized they are.
Let me tell you where I'm going to go
it
might be helpful to you. After you and Representative Bueller have a chance to talk, I'm going to ask Representative Notes to lead us through the bill one section at a time and have us comment on those in each section about how they might go. So I just wanted to give you a little insight.
Actually, Gloria's going to help us.
Yeah. I want to give him a little insight.
I guess my take is a little more generic and a couple of different thoughts. I think it was a couple of years ago, one of the more memorable experiences in being a state rep is I was delivering Meals on Wheels to this elderly lady in a trailer court, and I say trailer court, not mobile home park, if you get the difference. And she, as we visited, explained that she takes her daily blood pressure medicine every 3 days because she can't afford it. And I haven't been able to shake that. That was a traumatic moment. And incidentally, I was able to help her, so I'm thankful for some of the programs that we have. And I had privilege, or whatever it was, because it was several things, of working on the work group with Representative Nose and Representative Lively, and frankly, a goodly portion of the people in this room right now. That was complex, at times troubling, at times kind of interesting, and it's hard to wrap it up in a few words. I somewhat share Representative Hayden's view that in certain regards we're taking this a little too fast, but healthcare costs is a huge problem. And it'd be fun to go through this bill more specifically, because I think some of my reactions about the bill more specifically, and then I'll speak more generically, is I have some difficulty when we single out one boogie person. And healthcare is darn complicated. And
I've heard that.
Oh, that's right. My president said that. I forgot. Actually, I think I said it before he did, so he must have copied me. I don't know where he got it. It's been amazing to me serving on the Health Care Committee in my tenure in the Senate, except for the 1 year I got kicked off. And here in the House, it's been an interesting experience. But I guess a couple of different things. You need to start somewhere, probably in costs, but there's a lot of costs in the system, whether it's insurance, hospitals, providers, who I think are charging outrageous rates as a form of provider, I might add, and pharmaceuticals are part of that. And I also think a good point is that so much of this is also conditioned on federal that is at best on shaky ground, and I'm clueless. I don't know what others are, but I'm certainly clueless. And I don't know, but I need to add doubtful of hope, but that's mine. I think there are a couple of things that we need to remember as we look at this bill, and that is there are some extraordinarily bad players, and I don't know exactly how we rein them in, and that's always true. And I can say that about some other people participating in the process when I look at different parts of their repertoire. But I think on the whole, medication is actually one of the cheapest forms of healthcare treatment that we have. And I also see that innovation is dramatic, and we must be careful with that. My first wife, as I think most all of you know by now, died of complications from breast cancer after 8.5 year fight. It was interesting to sit, what was that, last November in the hearing, and learn that if she died 20 years ago, if she were diagnosed a few months ago, she would have a 99% chance of cure. A 99% chance of cure. It did make me cry. That's progress. And we see that with hepatitis and with some other things. On the other hand, we see outrageous conduct like EpiPens, and sometimes I believe homicide or murder is justifiable. So, you know, I think we need to be careful, and we've had even threats. I'm not sure whether that's fair or bad play of withdrawal from the marketplace, especially here since we can have an impact on national rate settings. So I'm concerned about that as well. I think it's time for some steps. Maybe this is an area where we might take some steps. I would encourage us to take modest steps and set the trend and start setting up other people for other groups for the same kind of heavy-duty consideration. Because I think what's fair for one is fair for all of us in the healthcare field. And I think there's plenty of room for lots of people to get lots of lumps. And if we're really committed to the best outcomes, then that's fair. And that's, you know, the hospitals, the practitioners, the pharmaceuticals, I think the insurance companies, all of us are players in that, and we all need to take our lumps.
Representative Julian, you ready for an open?
Back to me again?
After he got time to think.
Yeah, I appreciate all the wisdom you all shared with me around the table. Well, first, I appreciate Representative Nose taking on this problem. It's complex, and it's a problem that needs a solution. The excessive profit-taking at the high end of the market with the innovative specialty drugs, or at the low end of the market where there's clear market manipulation, needs to be fixed. I think we all agree on that. And I think Representative Nose and others who worked on this have the best of intentions, good intentions to fix this problem. But good intentions are not enough. We got to make sure we get the policy right, because we can have profound unintended effects on the entire healthcare system in this state if we don't get it right. Having said that, I have most concern about this bill on price controls. As I told Rob in a text a month ago or so, you know, price controls rarely, if ever, works, and I'll come back. There are situations where price controls are needed, and I'll come back to that. But most of the time, price controls are like heroin. It feels great in the short term, that first dose, and then when you keep on using it creates multi-system failure. And that's just the facts. Okay, the market will always find a way to get around the price controls, and you can have serious adverse effects. And I particularly have problems with the benchmark that is used for setting the price control here, which is the OECD. I've never seen that used for anything else. And those countries are a very unique healthcare market. Almost all of them are monopsony buyers. They're single health systems that have enormous of power to drive down the cost of those drugs. And it's not based on any market. And like Representative Kenny Garr said, they're held artificially down by the high costs that Americans are paying for the R&D. So I do not think that's a good benchmark to set the price. Ideally, this is a national solution. I have great concerns that if we don't have a national solution, we will have concentrated ill effects in Oregon. But I also share Representative Kenny Geyer's concern that I don't have a whole lot of confidence that it will be national solutions, and we have a long track record of seeing lack of progress on lots of issues, and I think one as complex as this, we won't see a national solution. But if we don't get it right in Oregon, we will become a flyover state for a lot of the specially innovative new specialty drugs. We have to keep in mind we're only 1% of the U.S. population. This market's not big enough to come into, to play in a special place that might put many of these companies at serious risk. Particularly concerning to me is what it will do to our burgeoning bioscience sector in this state, where not only do we have significant private money, foundation money, charitable money, and even our own state money in building this new sector, and we all should be proud of the enormous success so far that we're seeing from that. I mean, just drive by South Waterfront, come over to Bend and see the almost 50 bioscience companies that are starting in Central Oregon and hiring hundreds of people at way above average wages that are doing great work, and we put that entire sector at risk with something like this. And finally, I am greatly concerned that there'll be windfall profits for the payers, that many of these specialty drugs do produce enormous value in future healthcare savings. For example, the drugs to treat hepatitis C, they are expensive, I get it, but if they save years of hospital admissions, years of surgeries, thousands of organ transplants, that's a lot of savings. Why should payers capture all of those savings when most of the innovation and most of the risk came from the companies that developed those drugs? To me, that's just unfair. So how do you solve this problem? And one of my caveats when I started was that I don't like price controls in general. They're like heroin, except for under one condition. And that is when there is a monopoly situation. And in some of these situations where there is market innovation, we have a monopoly situation. That's when price controls should come into play, when you have bad actors in the market or when you think there's excessive profit taking. And I think that's where we should concentrate our efforts, and we should come up with a different and much better benchmark than the top five OECD countries. I don't know why top five. Maybe it should be a top three. Maybe the top 20. No, it shouldn't be any of them. It should be something based on real economic principles. And the best thing to do in this situation is a value-based pricing. That means that you calculate the value that's going to be saved in the future, you discount it to the present, and that is what sets the price. That's based on real economic value production. That's how it's done in other situations, and that's how we should do it. My two cents.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd like to make one more comment.
Go ahead.
Because it was kind of the conclusion I had, but I had it off in the corner and didn't see it. And that is, I guess, the final concern that I have is in Oregon, it's hard to get clear numbers, but pharmaceuticals are somewhere between 11 and 17% of the cost of health care. Nationally, it's around 10%. So it also, I think, we need to be careful to think that we solve the equation on 10 or 17% of the problem. By beating up on 10 or 17% of the problem, there's a lot of the rest of the problem there.
Yeah, and I was going to make an opening comment as well, if I may, okay. And I'll comment on that as a piece of it. I think some of you know that I started my career as a pharmacist, and I taught pharmacy management for several years before I went back to get my PhD. And I remember well this problem being raised in the mid-50s when I was in high school. It was a senator from Tennessee named Estes Kefauver who had Senate hearings about how drug companies were gouging us and distorting the healthcare system. And he was able to run that into a vice presidential nomination in 1956 with Stevenson. He and his coonskin cap ended up being a vice presidential candidate of the United States. pointing out many of the problems that you all discussed in your work group. I mean, life hasn't changed. It does seem to me, however, it's time to try and do something about this. And Oregon has been an innovator in a lot of areas. It would be great if we could innovate in this area. Why is this important? Representative Kenmer is right. Drug expenses run roughly, I think it's around 15-16%. But what I've just seen sitting on the PEB board looking at next year's bids is that half of the price increases in healthcare have been related to increases in drug prices. They're having a big impact on us going forward. And it isn't that, it would be great to drop to 15% to 13% by not raising hospital prices to make up for it, but the fact that it's impacting as we go forward in the future, I think it's really time for us to do something. I'm going to ask Rob to move forward with this a section at a time and ask you all to comment on these sections as you go forward to give him advice as he moves to create the next version of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we welcome Lori Freeman here with us.
The mic closer to her, too. So I want to thank all my colleagues for your comments and your insights, and for the chair for sort of setting it up this way. I don't think we often kind of get to hear what's rattling on in our brains about various things that we try to legislate over, and I found your comments all very helpful and insightful, and I appreciate it. This has been one of the hardest things I've ever attempted to do. I think rather than me trying to share a little bit to get right into it, if Lori and I would just walk through the bill, I think that makes the most sense. And I think if we just focus, Mr. Chair, on sections 1 through 4, because the sections that come after that sort of just deal with allowing the main parts of this bill to affect other parts of the insurance industry. The guts of the bill are sections 1 through 4. Would you agree? Yeah. So I think let's just kind of walk through that and let people sort of react to it, and then we'll sort of see where this goes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lori Freeman from Legislative Council. I don't know if I'm supposed to do all the protocols. Section 1 of the bill, as amended by the Dash 1 amendments, is, in my head, I think of as the rebate section, and it's what requires pharmaceutical companies to rebate to payers the excess costs of prescription drugs. Payers are defined, actually, over in Section 2, it includes insurers, third-party administrators, pharmacy benefit managers, PEB board, OEB, healthcare service contractors, and multiple employer welfare arrangements. And then in the original bill, excess costs had one definition, but the Dash 1 amendments changed the definition of excess cost to the difference between the average wholesale price and the foreign price cap. It also changes how you define the foreign price cap from being the highest price paid in the OECD countries.
OECD.
Whatever.
I had to practice it a lot of times.
To the mean of the 5 highest prices paid for a drug in any of those companies and on any of those countries. But really, the only actionable part of it, most of its definitions, is under subsection 2, which says that a manufacturer has to establish a process to pay these excess costs back to payers, and also has to give a prior advance written notice to payers not less than 60 days before an increase in a price of the drug that results in a cumulative increase of more than 3.4% over a 12-month period.
Mr. Chair, maybe before we launch into it, maybe I'll just share a little bit what was in my head about when I put this in the bill, and then let folks sort of react to that. So two things. One is, based on the amendment, we thought an average of the 5 made more sense than referencing it to just one of those countries. And the thinking behind that was, and I'll just say it kind of bluntly so it's clear, was that
why should folks in Oregon pay so much more than folks in other countries for these medications? And so that was sort of the reference. That was why that was chosen that way. And we thought that made more sense than the initial version of how we were trying to deal with a price rebate situation that we discussed in the summer, that even Chair Greenlick, I think, privately confessed to me did not think was very workable. So that was sort of our thinking behind that, and why we chose that approach. And the idea behind the notice is to try to have this be a little bit more regular and revealing, so that carriers could sort of predictably set a rate and have some predictability in the system and not have so much price fluctuation, where in a system where you set a rate, trying to figure out what you need to cover your costs and cover claims and have it change drastically and mess up your process for trying to determine what the premium should be.
Comments?
Sure.
Go for it.
So I think trying to take our healthcare system in America, in the United States of America, and then drill that down to Oregon and apply that to foreign countries is a really difficult concept to make a comparison, and I'm trying to get my computer to bring up the dash one, but what was in line 19 where it talks about foreign price, I don't see why we're not, I get the idea, I would prefer to start this with something of a narrow scope that had to do with the off-patent, the generics, medication that we can really put a framework together and we can prove that it works. Now it may not be an approach that solves everything. If you relate that approach to PERS, it might be putting a cap on PERS of the highest 10 people that receive PERS or something like that, right? That's an example of really not solving the problem, but stepping into doing something that might make a difference. Well, if we stepped in with off-label generic drugs and we said, okay, we in Oregon pride ourselves in the CCO, and now in OEB and PEP are going to try and pride ourselves into a 3.4% premium increase in the future, why wouldn't we tie it to something that's realistic, that is relative to Oregon, rather than something that might be relative to Yugoslavia or whatever countries you're picking, right?
let me put a question on the table. Is the issue that the fact that we're using the European or the OECD countries the problem? If we could find a price target that was related to something here in Oregon, would that make you more comfortable about it?
50%.
The whole question of the fact that there's a price target and a rebate rate.
I don't think the price target, having a price target, is a problem for a portion of the drug manufacturing. I think we could start with that. I think using a foreign, kind of a foreign pricing doesn't make sense for us. I don't think that's applicable. I think Americans do, unfortunately, carry a lot of the burden of research and development. I think Representative Kinnemer just made an outstanding point about advances that we've had in hepatitis C and breast cancer particularly. We can't discredit the value that there is in these going forward. And so I think if we come away from a foreign price point and apply it more to, okay, we're trying to stay within a percentage of increase of 3.4%, maybe it would be 5% for medication, but then narrow the scope down to generic drugs to at least get a framework working.
But the big problem is the high cost drugs.
The big problem is the high cost drugs are life-saving drugs. Yes, that's the problem.
Well, as somebody who's here today because of life-saving drugs for lymphoma treatment. I understand that. But I understand also the fact that I don't want to turn this into a debate, but I would like the others to comment on whether if that price was a price that was more understandable and more local, would that make the two more?
Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, just to your point, one of the things that's germane is that these high-cost drugs are extremely high cost on a per-patient basis. But when you put them into the larger context of the cost of medications, that dwarfs that cost pretty dramatically.
I'm not so sure of that. I feel like, yes. Mr. Chair, I feel like one of the slides I remember really clearly is that the bulk of Americans, our medications are generic, and we use a lot of generic mm-hmm. medications. But these relatively new drugs, they're like 1% of what's prescribed, but they're like 50% of the drug cost of that 16 or 17% of the spend on medical in the drug space. They're at least half of the cost.
Well, and it's also hard because, like with hepatitis C, in theory, you get rid of the disease.
Yeah.
Versus you talk about repeated hospitalizations. Over the term, it's cost effective by a very significant margin.
Thank you.
Say nothing of human suffering, by the way,
so,
which I should have.
Well, on this issue of price, first of all, I want to thank Representative Bueller for the big shout out to single payer systems. I think the OECD countries that have a very big bargaining ability in part have that because they don't have a fragmented system like we have. And so our maybe not. I took it that way. So in any case, I think the point is we have a very fragmented system. They have tremendous bargaining power. And as a result, they are able to bargain down the cost. And I think that your question, Mr. Chair, was does OECD, you know, pegging the price at what OECD, the top five countries for their median price, to me makes sense because these are countries that are developed. It's not like we're pegging it to Africa where we have to sell it way less and it may even be on charitable terms. So to me, that makes sense. I think exploring, I don't consider it price control. I think there are many ways in which we try to regulate prices, whether it's the health insurance, whether it's payday loan sharks, whatever. We try to put a certain cap, and we let a lot of flexibility in the market underneath that. So I see that as the analogy. I think value-based pricing, I have a lot of interest in that, and if there was a real proposal on the table around that, I think that would be of interest. I have heard that that pharmaceutical companies will often figure out what the cost of treating Hep C is, and then they will peg their price, and this is probably value-based pricing, to just under that, to justify why we would pay for that drug at that high cost, as opposed to some other kind of way to peg the cost. So I think that's not...
return on investment for other markets.
Yeah, so what? So it's not always... So I think they're able to bring the cost up to what people are willing to pay for it because paying for that drug is going to be cheaper than paying for all the hospitalizations. So I think it's got its concerns too, but I actually think in many cases value-based pricing is something that I support. And so if there's some way that could be built in, I would be supportive of that. But right now, in the absence of that, I think that the OECD pricing at that, and again, reminding everyone that it's only the times where the drug price goes over that the rebate goes into effect. That insurance is on the hook for any time that it falls under that, which I imagine is a significant amount of the time. It doesn't get triggered, and in that case, insurance has to pick up the added cost that the consumer can't bear.
Should we move on to section two then? Nobody else has any? Okay. Back to you, Councilor.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lori Freeman. Section two is the price cap for for the consumers. And basically, the same people who are going to get the rebates under Section 1 are obligated to cap the out-of-pocket costs for a consumer at, and under the amendments, it's $200 for a bronze plan and $100 for silver, gold, or platinum plans. The other thing that the amendment made is that cap used to be for a plan year, and this changes it to just a dispensing.
Yeah. So why don't I kick it off again? So in the summer, honestly, we had a more aggressive cap that the amendment that Lori Freeman just described replaces. And I hope you'll appreciate this, but when the insurance plans looked at how they would be able to implement that or not, they concluded it would be very, very difficult. And based on the change that we made in how the rebates would work, we thought a slightly less aggressive copay cap made more sense. This copay cap that's in here is the cap that I pursued in a bill in 2015 on behalf of a lot of different patient advocate groups. It did not pass. That's how I got into this work group, because that bill didn't pass. But that was the thinking behind that. So that's where that idea came from. And I think most of you know, I work for a labor union when I'm not doing this. And part of that job is bargaining health insurance. Even bargaining health insurance with hospitals for their employees can be very contentious because it's an expensive benefit to provide. And trying to minimize the exposure that people have for the cost of their medications is something I feel very passionately about and really support this part of the bill. But we'll get to this later. You know, I wanted to do something comprehensive. I didn't just want to fix one part of the problem and then not address other aspects of what's going on with the cost of medications.
So my concern with this section is that you are, again, not really taking a holistic view of this. I would imagine that the drug manufacturers that you're trying to control price on would be supportive of this, right? So they're like, yahoo! We can have whatever cost for a drug, because we know that in Oregon, that patient, which is a barrier for patients to pay, is removed, and we can put that price on the insurance company, and it could, in my opinion, actually inflate drug costs rather than reduce drug costs, which puts a bigger burden on our 3.4%. So,
that's what made me put this whole thing together, because doing one piece of it without doing other pieces does exactly what you said.
Yeah, okay, that's my concern.
Yep. That's why having four sections in the bill begins to offset some of it.
So then it's my job to discuss all four sections.
You're right. It is. It's all of our jobs.
So I would prefer, rather than putting those types of caps on it that could actually end up being a cost generator or a cost inflator for drug manufacturers, to look at something more of a prohibited act that says on the generic market or the off-patent market, for example, if you had, say, two or three or fewer manufacturers of the medication, that if they were going to increase the price of their medication, say, more than 5% in a 12-month period of time or 3.4% in a 12-month period of time, then that manufacturer would be required to notify the Attorney General in the state of Oregon and says, hey, we're going to increase our generic price by this amount of money for this X reason, right? On the biologicals, it is a harder thing to put some sort of structure in place like that. You might be able to. Unfortunately, it would have to be a lot higher than a generic 3.4%. But I think there'd be an opportunity to take the approach that they have to give justification for a large price increase on those biologicals that do save lives, in particular. rather than say, hey, you can manufacture these and you can price these, and you know in Oregon the market's only the person is only going to have to pay $500 or $250.
So you would argue against something like a $100 cap in the end of the month?
I would argue against that approach to it, yes.
Any other comments on the $100?
President Hack.
Thank you, Chair. I think for me it just goes back to the concern, the overall concern of the access to treatment and the availability to innovation, just the concerns that we heard early on in the hearings and just the overall concern of the access and the innovation piece. And think about Representative Kenemer's wife, too. I mean, just
hear of that. I was moved by a woman that was in my office. Who had two kids with hemophilia. And their prescriptions cost $10,000 a month each.
And she was in a, she had a very good health insurance policy, but it had a 20% copay on pharmacy up to a $6,500 maximum. Well, the kids' prescriptions were each $120,000 a year. So in order to get her kids' prescriptions in January, she had to come up with a check for $13,000 before she could get their first prescriptions of the year. I just thought, well, if it happened to me, yeah, I could afford to write the $13,000 check, but it'd be a little hard for most other people. And she was able to too, but it took all the reserves that her family had just to get her prescriptions for her kids. That's what made me very sympathetic to trying to find some way to get some cap. What a cap does is it moves it over to the premium of the policy rather than the individual's copay. And I would worry about it, as Representative Hayden said, I would worry about it all by itself, because all by itself it had consequences. But when you mix it with something that would get a rebate for the insurance company on the top side to help pay, that incidentally, we were told by MOTA that the $100 cap would cost about between 1 and 1.5% of premium. If they put that in, it would increase their premium. I said, well, that seems reasonable. Let's do it. But the truth is, that I think it needs to fit into a whole picture.
I agree. And just one comment on that, going from a $13,000 copay to a $100 copay, that's a big difference. I mean, dealing with the hemophilia medication in that scenario, yes. I certainly agree that we ought to take a look at that, but making them all $100, that's a huge...
Per month, I assume.
Per month.
But can I just... have another?
Please. No, please.
So, but my concern then goes back to the questions that I raised earlier, and that is, what happens to the increase in the premium then? Does this actually get passed on to the consumer, or are we, where's the guarantee there that that $1,300 check that they have to write then doesn't end up hitting them in another way in their premium or in other ways? How do we know that they're not going to end up getting hit another way? And we couldn't get that answered. And that's what was so key, I think. Not only do you have the innovation side, but you also don't have a guarantee that it isn't going to increase their premiums and we're not going to hit them in other ways.
That would clearly increase premium. The question is it worth a 1 or 1.5% increase in premium to protect? You either pay for it at the point of service or you pay for it in the premium.
And is it really only going to be 1 or 1.5%? We have no guarantee.
Well, that's what the health insurance premium review should make sure happen.
DCBS?
Yeah.
But DCBS only does, what, 20 or less than 25% of the review. So that was my other concern.
You mean the insurance that comes under DCBS? Yeah, that's about 40%.
But didn't they say that, yeah, I don't want to debate, but I didn't get all those questions answered yet either.
We need to send DCBS to see.
The review side, the portion that they actually yeah. review.
It's important to know for us to have.
Representative Guyer first, and then I want to.
So I'm just pulling this out of memory then, and I actually think it's from last year, from when you had the bill last year, not this year, that insurance companies predicted that if we stuck with the $100 a month, $200 for Bronzepan, and that cost then got lifted off the shoulders of the people who have chronic diseases or children with chronic diseases and spread out across the population, I think that the increase was somewhere around 0.5%. It would be nice to have someone confirm that here.
Mona told me specifically between 1 and 1.5%.
Okay. And my thought on that is none of us know when we're going to get the short end of the straw and end up with a really incredible expense, and that is the idea of insurance, is that you spread the risk across a greater. And so, you know, even at that point, I was supportive of the idea to help the people that really had, that had such extraordinary expenses. But even at the time, I recognized, but it'd be better if we didn't just go up a little bit in premium here in order to cover that expense all the way around, but that we also did something to lower the premium by trying to get on top of the pharmaceutical costs. So that was my feeling about what happens if, who's picking up that $13,000, because someone's got to
right.
pick up that cost. So the idea is that insurance picks up part of it, but to the extent that the $13,000 might be one of those inflated costs, that we have another mechanism to try to get at that as well. May or may not be. I'm not sure if the hemophilia drugs are in that category.
I couldn't get a guarantee when I'd asked those questions, so that was my concern.
Okay, maybe this is a good time for me to interject, Mr. Chair. So two things. One, I can post on OLIS the study that was done. I think it was on, I can't remember which of the patient groups did it. But
Milliman?
It was the Milliman study. And Milliman is a very reputable actuarial firm. This is the kind of thing that they do for insurance companies. And an advocate organization who worked with me on the first bill in 2015 went out and contracted with them to do the study to say, I think they said it was 0.5% or 1.5, it depends, but absolutely, that's what it would do to premium, you know, spreading the risk out to all of us payers rather than, you know, so in exchange for the lower copay. I don't know if this is the right time to ask maybe DCBS, Mr. Chair, to come up to the stand. I know the House Democrat Caucus is going to have someone come in and give a presentation just about rate setting so that our caucus gets a little bit more educated about how it works. But it might, maybe, you know, especially since Representative, in the first hearing, it was not the best forum to get a question answered. Maybe we could have DCBS come up now and just explain how the rate setting process works, because that's been an issue of contention.
Is there somebody here that can do
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
Or do you want to take Rep. Mueller first?
Representative Mueller?
So has there been a fiscal review of this?
Not yet.
This would have profound effects not only on...
It'll be the net. Once we get an amendment, you get the bill and the final memo will ask for a fiscal. They won't do a fiscal until you're ready to move the bill.
And my concern in past discussions of big bills like this, we haven't adequately considered the fiscal impact on other government entities.
Well, PEBIN, OEB are clearly a part of the fiscal.
Yeah, but there's
I expect this, we'll have a fiscal, and I suspect it will go to Ways and Means. That's my guess. How about you?
It's a very good guess, Mr. Chair.
Somebody here from DCBS?
Right there. Next to you.
Yes, sir.
Oh. Why did you say something?
I just wanted to make sure the conversation ended. So.
It's ended. Go for it.
You
should
introduce
yourself for the record.
Yeah, for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, the policy manager with the Division of Financial Regulation. Maybe it'd be best if I just got the question first, see if I can tackle it, and then we can go from there.
I think many of the committee is sort of, so here's one of the assertions has been is that my bill, the committee bill, is going to be a windfall for the insurance industry in this state. And I have tried to explain, not necessarily because we have a rate setting process, if the rebates are as generous as they might be, wouldn't that impact potentially the rate filing that would occur, and the insurance plans would have to take that into account when they establish rates. That's what we're trying to
understand.
Right. So under the insurance code, we are approving rates that are not excessive, essentially. We've got two aims, right? We want to make sure that insurance carriers are solvent and able to pay claims. Thank you. And also that the rates that they do set are not excessive for the consumers that are buying the insurance. So we look at all sorts of information to make sure that those rates are reasonable, to make sure that claims can be paid or not excessive, and I've already said that. But there's a concept in federal law called the medical loss ratio, and so it's insurers have to meet certain financial targets, and if they actually pay less in premium than they expected to pay, that gets rebated back to the consumers. And so we don't allow rates to be filed where a medical loss ratio rebate might be paid. So in that sense, the rates that are filed and approved would actually be lessened so that there isn't a possibility of an MLR or a medical loss ratio rebate to be paid out to the consumers. So in that sense, that if that provision was triggered and a rebate would be coming and we could see that actuarially, the rates would then, we'd ask those rates to be reduced in that respect.
Representative Bueller has a question.
Yes, sir.
And how are you going to do that for Medicare?
Well, that's a good question. So
how do you do that for what?
Medicare.
So the caveat is that we're looking at medical loss ratio is going to cover the individual market, the small group market, so that's 50 and fewer employees, I believe, or members, and then a large group as well.
So we're going to give a windfall to the federal government on this?
So Representative Bueller, I can only focus on the percentage of the market that we can.
Are you talking about Part D of Medicare?
I'm talking about all of Medicare.
I don't think that proposal affects Medicare.
It doesn't. We can only legislate around the commercial part or in the part that DCBS actually regulates, and then our own PEB and OEB. So this bill does not contemplate doing anything in the Oregon health plan space or in the Medicare space because it's not. In fact, periodically over the summer, there were folks that were sort of attempting to try to insert the CCOs or ask us to look at that, and then folks from the CCOs would come and say, well, we're a totally different animal, maybe you shouldn't include us. And so it's funny, just the other day, Representative Greenlick, myself, and Steiner Haywood, and I was just discussing this with Representative Hack the other day, the OHA is trying to figure out if they can do something in the prescription drug space that makes sense for them, but this bill would not be a vehicle or an approach to do that. We have to do something totally different.
Do you do premiums on Medicare Advantage plans?
I think that I will have to take that back and make sure I get the committee the right information, but I do believe we get some filings on Medicare Advantage, yes.
Which would be about these drugs anyway, because that's Part D.
Correct.
So can I ask you something to clarify then, please?
Sure.
So my understanding is in the rate review process, you are able to gather a certain amount of financial information mm-hmm. about expenses, actuarials, who insurance plans aim to cover. Right. And then if I can try to interpret what you just said in layperson's terms, you try to make sure that the number that comes in is not too high, that they have to justify why they're doing it because you want to make sure people are not paying premiums, excessive premiums that aren't justified. You also try to make sure that they're not too low because there's a fear that some may inadvertently do them too low and have miscalculated, or others may actually want to be trying to get the bottom of the market to capture a bigger market space, perhaps unfairly, and then all of a sudden, the next year, they're going to have to jack up the prices because they weren't able to cover their costs.
Right.
So that is how I interpret the role of what you do. There's a tremendous amount of transparency. There's consumers that are a part of that. I'm looking at Jesse right behind you, who are part of that. You have a public review process, and that is how you get into your price regulation.
That's, yes, Representative Kennedy, that's correct. I mean, okay. We have a robust, effective rate review process that's recognized by CMS, the Centers for Medicare.
So can I just follow up? So if, yeah. for instance, rebates came back, because rebates were triggered, and rebates came back into the to the insurance companies, that would be considered as you go forward, what happened in the previous year and the amount of revenue that came in, whether it was from rebates or whether it was premiums or anything, would be considered a part of how you determine the premiums in the year going forward.
That's correct. I mean, we're trying to look to see that, well, setting aside any other cost drivers, right? If we do believe that this particular provision of federal law could be triggered, then we want to make sure that those rates are reduced so that that isn't the case.
So can I ask one more question, Mr. Chair? Do you think that in the system that you have now, is there a chance that insurance companies could receive a windfall from this bill?
I mean, you know, Representative Kenny Geyer, I think what we would do as an agency is to work to make sure that those rates are, as the insurance code is telling us, that they're reasonable and not excessive.
But if there was an unexpected wind day this year, you would take that into account in next year's rates.
That's right. Yeah.
Representative Cameron's got his hand up, and then maybe Representative Hack does too.
Just speak up.
Yep, yeah, Mr. Chair. Ms. Blackburn.
Yeah.
So DCBS only has this regulatory control over about what percentage of the marketplace?
The Representative Kenmare, the last chart that I saw was about 20% of the market. Yes.
And so with OEB and
what?
Have attached.
Does that include OEB?
No.
No, we include OEB in the statute.
Well, that's part of what we're talking about. Is
that's about another 300,000 people.
So, what percentage of the marketplace would that bring it to?
No, the total percentage of the state-regulated market is 20%. That's excluding PEB and OEB.
And if you included them, how
much would 300,000 PEB and OEB.
What is the, well, so enrollment figures for about 130,000 for OEB large group insured, and then for PEB large group insured is 30,576. Oh, PEB self-insured, 105,000. I'll get these numbers
PEB's
to the committee.
So.
Yeah.
But that's what, another 5%, 25%? I'm just ballparking.
About 8%.
I'm just trying to understand what piece of the market we're getting.
I think that adds another 8%.
What?
It adds another 8%.
8%.
What I'll do, I'll make sure to get these numbers to the committee after we've met those. So.
You guys need to share.
So that was my concern, that if you're regulating and checking 20% of the market, and it goes back to my original concern of whether or not we can make sure that folks aren't being gouged with premium increases and that we're taking care of the gal with the $1,300 a year. $13,000, sorry, got a big difference there. Copay, with 20% of the market only being regulated by DCBS, that scares me.
Well,
that's the only percent of the market that's covered by this bill, is the ones that they regulate plus web and because of web. And, okay. Yeah.
So just for a point of information, we can't regulate the self-insured market, so that's governed by federal law, that's ERISA. So many large employers don't purchase insurance this way anymore. They set up an ERISA plan, and they take on all the risk. And one of the benefits of being a large employer, they often can spread out the risk, and so they have more reasonable copays often. You know, like part of what we're trying to do is folks that have to purchase insurance on the exchange, candidly, I mean, when I look at those plans relative to what I attempt to bargain even at hospitals, it's often not as good, right? And for sure, those exchange plans, many of them are not as good as the benefit design that we enjoy as legislators or state employees or universities enjoy through the PEB system. So that's...
But this bill doesn't include Medicare, it doesn't include Medicaid, doesn't include any of the self-insured market. So it's not, it only includes people that they regulate. That's all the bill is aimed at. The individual market, the small group market.
So what happens to the rest of all those folks?
They're not included in the bill.
We would have to have a different approach to solve the drug problem for the Oregon Health Plan folks, right? I mean, and maybe that should be the next work group I get saddled with.
No, we'll give that to
Representative Hack is going to join me on it. And then
In terms of the self-insured plans, the ERISA plans, I don't have a, I honestly don't have a good answer for how you deal with that from a state perspective.
There are ways
so not knowing what happens at the federal level, how does this affect that?
Doesn't affect it at all. These are people who are in our health insurance market now. It'll affect the exchange population,
yeah,
probably, but it won't affect the individual.
So if the exchange population were to go to the open market, then what?
It would be included.
The extent to which they were individuals, they would be included in the regulation. The extent to which they'd be picked up by their small groups, they would be under regulation. Other than that.
And then they would be regulated by DCPS?
They would be regulated by, and the drugs would come under.
Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah, and I think your point is a good one that is distressing, is that we're addressing where a modest percent of the population.
Yep. Okay. The huge problem that not just a modest percent of the people face.
That's
so
right.
I think that while we're intending to help a lot of people, we're actually not helping near as many as what.
That's true. It would only be about 1 million people we'd be affected by this.
And how many people actually?
Well, there are 4 million in the population. This would be about 1 million.
Right, because about 25% of our population is on the Oregon Health Plan, right? And then 25% are either in the individual market, the exchange market, the small group, or PEB and OEB, right? And then the other 50% get their insurance either through Medicare, which we should probably know that, I don't, or they get it because they're part of an employer that has an ERISA plan, and they're just not in the system.
Probably most of them are public employees. Most of them are public employees.
They're included in.
Right. Most of our public employees are getting benefited by this.
Right.
And everybody else is just.
We will have, I think we'll wait till our deadline is over, but there's a really good insurance report that comes out by DCBS every year. I'll ask them to come in and report on this so we can get, it's a very interesting report and a very good one. And it explains the market, which in Oregon is pretty complicated.
Should we? It's get mindful of the time. We haven't, and there's still two other sections of the bill.
Okay, let's go.
Maybe we should do the next section. Thanks for your question.
Yeah.
So I do. Can I just ask one really quick question? Do the price plans include all drugs, or just those sold in insurance?
So the drugs that are included are ones that you would purchase at a pharmacy. So there was a debate about maybe like certain drugs are taken only in hospitals, and we decided that was a whole other can of worms, and they're part of the medical benefit as opposed to the pharmacy benefit, and we didn't go into that space. Does that make sense?
So even if they're not covered by insurance, it's still getting to the, okay.
No, think of it as two pots of medicine, one that you take when you're in the hospital, and then one that you take when you a physician or a nurse practitioner prescribes it for you. We're focused on the part that's prescribed outside the hospital setting.
The ones in the hospital are covered by the hospital insurance, not by the pharmacy
yes.
benefit.
Which
usually.
Yeah, I mean.
If you like the bill, maybe we could extend it.
Carry it. Okay.
Let's move on.
Section 3.
Okay.
Good luck.
So sections 3 and 4, actually. They're called Reporting the Cost Basis and Patient Assistance Programs. Section 3, the first subsection is all definitions. The second subsection is some reporting about the cost basis that pharmaceutical companies, manufacturers have to make with respect to drugs that either have an introductory price exceeding $10,000 or if the drug is going to increase more or has increased more than 3.4% over a 12-month period. And so in subsection 2A, you have a list of the factors that have to be reported if it's over $10,000. And then if you come down to B, Well, the original bill is page 4. Let's see. And we've, let's see, where am I? Okay. And then in B, it's basically up to the department of DCBS to figure out what has to be reported. And they can have one or more of the things that apply to drugs that exceed $10,000. The amendment adds also a third reporting requirement, and that's that at least annually, for each of those drugs that either exceed $10,000 or had an increase of over 3.4% over a 12-month period, that the pharmaceutical manufacturer has to report the 10 highest prices paid for the drug in the OECD countries. And then subsection 3 just begins with additional reporting requirements for manufacturers to report on their patient assistance programs that they provide in this state. And then it lists a few of the things that have to be reported: number of residents who participated in the program, cost of the drugs, number of refills that qualified, and so forth. Those all appear in lines 29 through 43 on page 4. And then the last subsection says that DCBS, that's just sort of an extension of time, they can ask for additional information. Subsection 6, which begins on page 5, line 13, says that they have to post the information on the website.
I think that's the gist of it.
Yep. So at the 1,000-foot level, two things that we were trying to accomplish with this part of the bill. I think a lot of times we don't understand why the costs of these medicines go up. So KGW did me a favor. They didn't know it, but they investigated a bunch of medications and came up with a list of medications that went up 100% or more over a 4-year period from 2012 to 2016. And I think this list has been on OLIS, and maybe it's been circulated to you, so you know, you can look at it and see. And you know, part of the transparency part of this, or the reporting part of this, is to try to get some understanding of why the increase is so much over such a short period of time. And on the record, two of the advocates who opposed the bill, one of their criticisms was that I think one said in one hearing, 3,000 drugs that their companies make go up 10% a year every year. And then in a different hearing, it was either 2,200 or 2,300 of their drugs go up 10% each year, you know, every year. And, you know, that, trying to get a handle on why that happens, I think is a pretty big part of this, right? And then the other piece is trying to understand what offering coupons and incentives do to the price of the drug, what they charge, and what that means the insurance plan ends up picking up in terms of the cost. And is that doing anything weird in the market? And is everybody getting access to those coupons and those discounts and benefits, or is it a little bit by luck that you find out about it, and so then ergo you get help affording the cost of your medications, but somebody else does not? So trying to get a handle on what that charity care from the drug manufacturers is or is not doing in the market space.
Those are
the
thoughts.
Do you have any concern about this being proprietary information shared among and what that does to?
I have some.
To innovate and to even want to, and why would I want to participate if I'm going to put on my hat of especially a small innovative drug company? And I'm going to provide all this proprietary information to have access to a state with 1% of the national population and incorporating only 20% of that market.
Why would I do that?
I don't know that it's all proprietary. I got to be honest with you. I have gotten no feedback from any of the folks who'd be affected by this about what I could take out because it's so proprietary or it's so tied to trade secrets that it needs to leave. So far, in the negotiations that I've had with this bill on the side, as long as Section 1 is in the bill, I'm not getting any intelligent feedback about how to make the disclosure parts of the bill, the reporting parts of the bill, less onerous or take that into account. So if other folks have whispered those ideas into some of your ears, I'd be very open to hearing that. I'll just say this and then I'll be quiet. I do think, though, to say that we ought not to figure out what is causing a drug to go up 287%, 509% over a four-year period, 664% over a four-year period. I mean, there's something going on there, and I think that's not a trade secret. That's not proprietary. That's something else. And it's brand and generic drugs that are doing that. And to think, yeah.
I just want to note that on page 5, subsection 6, which starts on 13, it says that they don't have to post on the website information that's likely to compromise the financial or competitive position of the manufacturer.
Okay. And that was the question I had, is how strong a language and how protective and how subject to abuse is that language, if I can ask that broader question.
Or FOIA requests.
What?
Or FOIA requests.
What's that?
Okay.
I don't know what that is.
Freedom of Information.
I don't know.
Question.
Sure.
On your top 100 drug increases, the timing 2012, 2016, is that correct? Do you have anything like that information before the ACA?
I bet somebody does. I don't have that at my fingertips. That's an interesting question. But no,
meaning
I don't have that.
Is it possible that the regulation of the ACA itself driving drug costs? I don't know who would have that. I'm asking a question I don't know the answer
that,
to.
I'm not, that's an interesting observation. Representative Hayden, I'm not sure how to comment about it because at one level, we have an act that gets more people access to health care, and then in response to that, drugs that are generic that have been on the market for a long period of time suddenly radically go up in price. I still go back to my comment from 2 minutes ago, like there's something going on there that does not feel right to me.
The ACA gets abolished, the drug prices will go down.
The question is the mandate to provide them directly or indirectly causing the
I don't know.
But it would seem like it would be more of an even where there's these drugs that have these huge spikes and other ones have little spikes. I mean, why it's such an unevenness to it?
Representative Buehler's had his hand up. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. I've heard the contention from some major leaders of insurers in the state that they believe one of the big drivers of this, and I agree, it seems very fishy to me. You know, I'm not justifying that in any way. It's because of the ACA taking away the out-of-pocket maximum. So before, that acted as a lid on the market in terms of pricing, and when that went away, that kind of lid went, was eliminated.
Annual maximum? I mean,
The out-of-pocket maximum was taken away with the ACA.
Oh, the caps it at 12,000.
And how would that allow drug prices to go up more? I don't understand that connection.
Because they didn't want people to exhaust their out-of-pocket maximum, so it kept an artificial lid.
That's assuming pharmaceutical companies didn't want people to, because they wouldn't buy the drug anymore. Is that the thinking?
Well, I don't know. That is interesting.
They would find an alternative because they had a set of dollars that they would have to spend, or they found an alternative under the ACA.
They actually raised the premiums and make the drugs more available. But they're not limited by it. I mean, if you run out of your out-of-pocket premium, out-of-pocket maximum, the insurance has to pay for the rest. That would increase the demand for drugs, not decrease
it. And then therefore,
that's right, because now insurance can't do that, so they have to pay for it. So that's, I just
want to make sense. I'll look into it a little bit, but I've heard that.
Okay.
Can we do one more section there?
No, those are the four sections.
Well,
nope.
We didn't get to the four.
Sorry.
We have four.
Okay. Council is telling us we have one more. Go ahead.
So, would this not be considered under the federal law, the anti-competitive? About that, when you have to put out there that you're going to have a price increase?
I don't know.
Is that a question?
There's going to be a price increase. Can you do that?
Oh, like antitrust? I mean, like
in the same sense, but the anti-competitive.
What was the question again?
There's a federal law that's anti-competitive. So if you're going to put it out there that you're going to increase, what would be the stop of?
How do you all feel about the transparency issue in general? I have a sense of, my opinion, you all know.
I will just say I'm less passionate about that piece of it, which is a little ironic since I had the bill last year that led to this workforce. I had the transparency piece, Rob had the copay. I feel like if we, part of that was trying to get at how do you justify these high costs, but it kind of begged the question of what do you do when you find out what that information is. And so
you believe what you get.
You believe what you get, but also so what? Okay, so we found this out that whatever, the fair cost going into it, R&D, safety and assessment, all the different things that have to happen, and the cost is a lot more. There's still no mechanism to do anything about it, and so that's why I'm particularly passionate about the first part. I think if you can tie some of the transparency somehow to the individual rebates and coupons that people get, if there's some reason for it, then I think it might be justifiable, but I'm not... I don't want to make these companies go through the hoops unless there's some lever or something we can do about it. So I don't mean to be overly onerous. I want to have mechanisms to keep our costs down.
Kenema?
Yeah, I guess one of the problems I'm having is with transparency is that it's a great word and it's very PC, but I don't know that it gives us useful information.
It might,
and it might not. You know, what I find interesting is as I try to research some medications, you can get remarkably different costs.
Oh, yeah.
And that's very troubling to me. There isn't an equity in the market. So you can, you know, when we notice that, especially internationally, but even locally, you know, one person is paying a tenth of what another person's paying, and another person's paying 10 times even that. And depending on their policies and on the discounts they get and whether they know. And then the other day, one of the pharmacy people was talking to me and giving me some information where people can contact and receive apparently medications for free. So, you know, you start thinking about that, that's a pretty darn good deal.
As a researcher, I tell young researchers when they come with this whole list of questions, tell me what you're going to do with that answer. You don't need a bunch of answers. You don't have questions to go to.
Yeah.
And I worry about this being a lot of great answers if somebody can only figure out what the question is.
Representative Ackerman.
I mean, and I love the transparency side too, but I look at it for one and think, what are we going to do with all of it? Where are we going to keep it all, the data and all the information? Who can understand it? And on the other side of that, on a competitive side, if I'm a competitor and I see that somebody's selling something for more, than what I am, and let's say it's a lower cost even drug, then heck, if I can increase it by 50 cents, I'm going to. If I can increase it by a buck, I'm going to. So I guess I look at it that way too and say, even if it's not a huge increase, what's going to keep folks from not looking at that and saying, across the board, I can, you know, if I'm below average, it gives me an opportunity to increase.
This isn't just really about prices. I mean, we know what the prices are.
Okay. Yeah, but I think it's...
Any PBM was there with the price.
It's all part of that, though, isn't it?
This is a question of what went into that price. How much was marketing? How much was research? That's where the transparency gets you. The price is only kept secret because the pharmacy benefit managers have this list that tells what they're going to pay for anything.
So you're not including any of that. So you're going to include what it costs them to market it and what it costs them to...
Well, because we're trying to get at, and then I want to let Representative Hayden ask his question, make his comment. We're trying to understand what caused a drug over a four-year period to go up so much. What did you do different? Was it you had a
justification?
Representative Kenny Geyer an awesome salary because she researched a new cure to it, or we had a scandal and we had to pay out an employee, you know, something, or we decided
you named the stadium,
or you named I mean,
okay.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee, Vice Chair Noe. So, great discussion. My concern is on this particular issue is our curiosity to peek behind the curtain of drug manufacturing worth the unintended consequences of these manufacturers going and innovating in a different state? They're going to innovate, but they don't necessarily have to innovate in Oregon. And would the results of us peeking behind the curtain of what they're doing, would we be able to utilize that to a benefit greater than the risk of them innovating outside the state of Oregon? So I think, you know, we have a lot of these innovation engines working in Oregon. I think they're successful in our educational area. So I think we have to be very balanced and we have to be very cautious with this whole concept. And I would be supportive of doing something dialed back a little bit, something that didn't put our innovation at risk in Oregon, something that started the process of dealing with off-label or generic medications so we could get a platform worked out that wouldn't put the 20% of people that are insured through this process or 30% at risk of their premiums spiking unintentionally because we tried to create a rocket to go to the moon rather than go out in the backyard and do one that you might have done in Boy Scouts or something to figure out how to do it, right? So I don't want it to blow up on us. The other thing, just in my...
It's a good analogy.
My comment... is proud of my members here. We didn't know that we were going to have that. We didn't know that we were going to be presenting. So all of the members on my side of this discussion have provided this to you off the cuff and from our knowledge that we knew before we walked in the room because we did not know that this was going to be this type of discussion. So I'm proud of you guys for stepping up and being able to have a robust conversation in a 30-second notice forum.
Actually, I did mention what we were doing at the last.
I thought we were listening to people.
Representative, yeah, go ahead.
So the part about transparency for manufacturers means all manufacturers, not just those in Oregon? Or is it just for the ones in Oregon?
Neither. It's for things that are sold in Oregon.
It's for manufacturers that are selling
in Oregon.
It's not because you're based. It's not because you're manufacturing it in Oregon.
That's why you have to be concerned about whether the service is.
Yeah, but I think there's been a lot of talk about, oh, this is really hard on particularly the R&D, and we don't want to squash innovation, or, you know, all of the centers and the South Waterfront and et cetera. You know, because they're based here, but in fact, this bill does not do anything to them that it doesn't do to manufacturers all around the country. It's got nothing to do with where they're headquartered. Right?
Well, yeah, I think so.
Creates an atmosphere, a culture that would make them skittish of continuing to put multi-million-dollar investments in a state that puts them at risk of disclosing some of the most valuable information. So where does it stop? Right, if you have to provide the information to sell here, what's the next time you're going to have to disclose your information?
But I remember from the hearing that, so I perhaps that's true with the culture, but I remember from the hearing last time there was a person who said, you know, we're developing a business here and we might have to, if this passes, we might have to move to California. And I thought, any of the drugs that they're selling, it doesn't matter if they're based in California or Maryland or here, what they're selling, if, again, if the price exceeds the OECD top five country mean average, then they would be triggered. But there's nothing that makes it that's just as true if they're headquartered in California as it is here.
Unfortunately, because of venture capital money, they're moving to Palo Alto or Austin or Boston anyway. We need to figure out how to get more money into the second level funding.
Their capital gains tax rate in Oregon. That's one of the big things that sends people out of here when they have a liquidating event after developing a high.
Yeah, but they said they don't have to pay anything in corporate profits. But no, I think we need venture capital. I mean, that's why I put a bill in to get $100 million of venture capital. I think that's it. Representative Hayden, I'm sorry if there's a sense that I sprung this on you. I thought I really suggested that I wanted a chance that we could talk to each other.
Well, thank you. If appropriate, I'll apologize to my members if I didn't communicate that correctly. My understanding that it was going to be an open panel discussion with questions from the audience to be covered here. Like we've got a panel right up there that would love to come up to the mic, right?
We have a whole room full of people. They've been talking to us.
Perhaps a little misunderstanding between us, but no, we were not prepared with statements from my side.
Well, to compound that, would you like to make a final statement?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to say something because I was pretty nervous about how this was going to go. Again, part of my union background before I got here is it's very rare when one side of a negotiation gets everything they want. Compromise is part of solving the contract. Sometimes the employer actually does have legitimate interests that the union has to sort of deal with in order to make their business work so that we can get paid and continue to have jobs and all that, right? And you work that out. And so by nature, yes, I take a position on something, but I understand I do have to make compromises and listen to other points of view. And I want to just say that I have found this to be very, very valuable. So I've been taking notes. I'm listening to the things that you've said. I felt like I've had more insight into what my peers think for a change about something than just sort of us reacting to information and maybe parroting something, maybe not. But like, I found this actually quite rich. And I don't know that I'm going to want to amend the bill in every single way that some of you have suggested, but I definitely have some other ideas now in my head about what I might try to do to make this more palatable.
Well, and if I may, I may come chat with you being more prepared to have a little more conversation because we were not prepared to do that. So if I may reserve my option to do that. I appreciate your willingness to have those conversations, so thank you.
You know, if you'd like to put something on the record, that's no problem, too. Okay. If you'd like to enter a statement on the record, we'll take it in. I would like you to get ready to get the next version of the bill.
Yep, I'm going to work on it. I know what I'm doing this weekend.
So,
don't call me, all of you in line.
So I just want to say for process, if anyone thinks that the chair or the vice chair on the side prepped us more. That actually didn't happen. The only discussion that I've really had about this came out of what our last time we had the public hearing on it, and the chair said, we're going to save time to have a work session where we all actually talk about it together. And so I've had no email saying, hey, get ready, we're going to have a just so you know, our vice chair didn't do any more than your vice chair.
I gave you all that prep information, you didn't hear it?
I didn't hear it. But I do remember that you were very clear in the public hearing that we were going to reserve time because there were a lot of people that wanted to talk about it. And I remember sitting on my hands because you had said that we were going to set aside time where we could talk to each other and where we could invite people up, as we did with the DCBS. If we had further questions for them. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for giving us the opportunity.
I'd really like to do this more regularly.
I would too, actually.
I like the format.
On other topics.
I like the format, and next time I will.
Well, you got what I carry around in my head today.
Right.
I think you did a pretty good job.
Yeah.
And I do like the format, but now that I understand it, we'll be a little more dialed in.
Representative Lawrence will be on.
I would just like to. Publicly acknowledge the work that Rob Knows has done. I probably am the least knowledgeable in the healthcare world out of the entire committee, and so I'm learning a lot. And I was a little bit intimidated when I came here about the process, and I do remember Chair being like you saying that we were going to have discussion, but I didn't know it was the whole time. And certainly I would have come probably more prepared. But what I do want to acknowledge around this specific process, and I've read through the entire bill, and certainly when you're reading bill language, that sometimes things don't make sense. But when you have discussion like this, you're able to then, you have read it, you've processed it, you've kind of internalized based on what your knowledge base is. But having discussion where somebody is able to, in respect to Representative Knows, Vice Chair Knows, be able to say, this was my vision around it. This is how I see it working. And then all of us having discussion around that vision, whether that made sense to us or not. So I do actually, now that we've completed the process or are almost about to complete the process, that I do appreciate having this format. And that we should be doing it more often, actually, when it comes to very complicated bills such as this, because this is about, I think anything we do in respect to healthcare is really about the communities we serve. We want to make sure that they stay healthy, that we make it affordable for them, and that their voices are heard in these conversations. So. Thank you, and I just want to reiterate that at the end of the experience, I really appreciated this format.
Well, I'd like to thank Madam Administrator, for helping to organize this and getting this room set up, and the wonderful Lori Freeman for being here with us. A very important part of our process. And Representative Kenmer, I want to acknowledge you sat through those hours of meetings with Representative Knows. You deserve to have any last word you want on this discussion.
I don't see it ending.
I'm afraid Representative Knows. Thank
that
you.
Was pretty
thank
good.
You. That was very good. Thank you very much thank for all your work on this one.
Okay.
No good deed goes unpunished.
That's for sure.
The work session on House Bill 2387 is closed. We are adjourned. Closed. We are adjourned.